personality. What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality. Your personality is the way you affect other people. Think about that. The way you affect other people.
KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
Hi, this is Mark Torres from the Pacifica Radio Archives, and this is From the Vault, the original weekly series from the Pacifica Radio Archives that puts our history back onto the radio. Many people today long for that better America. When the economy was purring, American schools were the envy of the world. The middle class exploded with livable wage jobs. Think back to that time when middle class Americans could afford homes in the suburbs and higher education. Summer family vacations were the norm. These people usually refer to the post-World War II middle class expansion, culminating in a decade usually referenced when people today refer to the good old days. In the Pacifica Radio Archives, we have a series of lectures from America's preeminent sociologist of the 1950s, David Riesman, a Harvard sociologist who spoke about this new post-World War II phenomenon. In this first lecture, Riesman talks about Alexis de Tocqueville's Thoughts on America. De Tocqueville, you will remember, is a French diplomat and philosopher who took a trip throughout America in the early 1930s and wrote his masterpiece work, Democracy in America, published in 1835. Maybe if we take a look back at the good old days, when the good old days were actually happening, we might learn something today. Here is David Riesman from 1958 with his talk, De Tocqueville and American Democracy.
In reading recently a number of reviews of Max Lerner's new book on America, a book I recommend, I've been struck by the fact that a good many reviewers, including Henry Steele Commager and others, speak of it as in the tradition of Tocqueville and Bryce, or compare it with Tocqueville and Bryce, which I found a curious juxtaposition. True, both men were foreigners, both famous, both had an interest in constitutional, political, municipal matters, but otherwise it seems to me they have very little similarity. Bryce, like Murdahl later, wrote a capable and compendious book about this country, a going concern when he was here, with deep-seated problems, constitutional and political. Tocqueville did not know he was coming to a going concern. In fact, his aristocratic outlook made him doubt whether such a country, which appeared to violate so many traditions, could last, could endure. As my colleague Marvin Myers has pointed out, and incidentally his book, which has just been published, The Jacksonian Persuasion, is the best book I know on the time of when Tocqueville was here. Marvin Myers has observed that Tocqueville's surprise that America did run, his astonishment at the American achievement, was a source of his own achievement. Tocqueville shared the concern of the authors of the Federalist Papers with the tension inherent in the democratic way between liberty and equality. But he came to Jacksonian America not as a Federalist, soured by the triumph of Jackson, although many of his informants were such Federalists. He came as a Frenchman, soured by French reaction and troubled by what had happened to the French Revolution in his own country. He came with that integrity which marked his whole life. After the new regime of 1830 had come to power, and he had not wanted to come to terms with it, he got a leave of absence with his friend Beaumont. Both of them were young French magistrates. And for his political health, decided it would be a good idea to be absent from France and present elsewhere. The elsewhere was somewhere, it was here. His excuse, not entirely an excuse, was that he wanted to study French prisons, American prisons. And when I think of this and of the fact that Dickens and many other visitors to this country at this period looked at American prisons, I wonder whether there is any country in the world so benighted now, maybe Thailand, maybe Ghana, that they would come to study prisons in this country. He and his friend Beaumont did their duty by the prisons, but his ambitions and curiosities were greater, much greater. To be sure, a recent commentator on Tocqueville has declared that Tocqueville, unlike such writers as Max Weber, did not work by the method of ideal types, that is, abstract types, but rather described an actual place, America in the 1830s. This is only partly true. Tocqueville did accumulate an immense amount of information about this country, especially in volume one of his two-volume book. But his true preoccupation, then and later, was with the shape of the future, with the evolution that liberal democratic institutions would take and would continue to take. As he wrote in his introduction, I confess that in America, I saw more than America. I sought there the image of democracy itself, with its inclinations, its character, its prejudices, and its passions, in order to learn what we have to hope or fear from its progress. America, lacking a feudal past, represented for his imagination the future as it would soon present itself to the rest of the world with the collapse of feudalism. And since he was moralist as well as seer, and seer because he was moralist, it indicated the limits of the alternatives men had in resolving the dilemma between liberty and equality. He used the American example to warn his countrymen, whether conservative like himself, or happy, optimistic children of the Enlightenment and the Revolution. Democracy is coming. It cannot be gainsaid. But it will come either as a leveler, with men equal but puny beside the monstrous state, or as an emancipator, with liberty as a result of law, as the result of local self-government, and as the result of consensual traditions resting on a religious foundation. In other words, he used the American case in order to envisage what equality of condition, which he thought was the central theme of America, would look like if it should be unchecked by counter tendencies. That is, he looked not at America as it was, with its complex reminiscences of older patterns, particularly in the South, and also in New England. He looked at America as it might be if it was more American, and then asked himself what could be done about a country that would look like that. The counter tendency against a leveling equality, which seemed to him most efficacious, was political liberty, and its concomitant encouragement to form decentralized associations for not only civic but also private purposes. like his friend and intellectual ally, John Stuart Mill, he saw political liberty as primarily an educational device, which would teach men, reduced in individual stature by equality, to remain or become self-reliant and realistic. He thought of politics as a school for individuals, and he thought of the town meeting as a school, and he thought of America's active associational life as a school. He spoke to his timorous and conservative French friends when he wrote in Democracy in America, "Political associations may be considered as largely free schools, where all the members of the community go to learn the general theory of association. Thus it is by the enjoyment of a dangerous freedom that the Americans learn the art of rendering the dangers of freedom less formidable." This unremitting sense of responsibility for the future of his own troubled country, which is evident also in his later works, his Recollections and his Ancien Régime, is a quality also which links Tocqueville to Max Weber in the latter's brief period of political activity after the First World War. Weber kept telling his German students and friends, among them many romantic conservatives, hostile to industrialization, hostile to democracy and socialism, that they had better accept the modern industrial world rather than join reactionary movements, and that they should then try to preserve within what he called the iron cage some of the personal qualities he and they admired. He was saying that socialism was but another form of the modern bureaucratic industrial world, that it could perhaps be tempered by liberal and humane values, but neither wished away nor fought away. Fought away, for instance, by the Freikorps, the early precursors of the Nazis, who at the end of the First World War paraded around the eastern frontiers of Germany and forayed into Poland. Like Tocqueville, Weber realized that an unqualified reliance on aristocratic tradition would engender either revolution or frivolity, that the only hope of preserving any tradition lay in moving with rather than against the trend of the post-medieval world. It is necessary to grasp the moral intention and vision of Tocqueville to interpret his discussion in his second volume of what today we would call American Patterns of Culture. The America he sees, in quotations, is like anyone else's, a selection, indeed a conception, an idea of America. And in my view, it is in many respects at least as accurate today as it was 100 years ago. When Tocqueville describes, for instance, the impact of democracy on literature and on the arts and what he called the trade of letters in book one of volume two, he is describing, it seems to me, the contemporary world of mass culture even more than he was describing the embryonic culture industry of the 1830s. And when he talks about Americans as joiners, ceaselessly active in associational life, it is my impression that Americans today join even more groups more often than in his day. This anticipation of the future in Tocqueville, this curious feeling one gets in reading him, that he was writing more for today than for his own day, is not only the result of the ideal typical method, but also of any student's problem in discovering what is typical. The Americans who are visible, even to the most searching visiting firemen, are likely to be the active ones, those who include him in. And when we trace Tocqueville's American hegira, as we can do through the wonderful book of Pearson, Tocqueville and Beaumont in America, we realize that despite trips to the frontier and the mixing that occurred on boats and steamboats and stagecoaches, the Frenchman inevitably met more American Americans, more of the articulate, the enterprising, the affiliated, than of the isolated and submerged. They met conservative lawyers, Hudson River patricians, politicians in Washington, trade-minded farmers, that is, farmers who were using their land in an industrial way, as we would see now in California, and who would sell it as soon as they had raised a few crops, despite their efforts to avoid being confined to the orbit of the characteristic foreigner. However, as I've indicated, Tocqueville's imagination transcended circumstance. He was not, as Mr. Harris said, afraid to generalize, to extrapolate beyond the existing America he saw to the democratic nations and, in Whitman's terms, democratic vistas he foresaw. Years later, as an historian of the French Revolution, he developed methods we associate with later historical scholarship in his effort to get beneath the easy legends based on what the spokesman of an era said about it. He caught also the views of the less articulate, whose attitudes could only be reconstructed from petitions to petty officials or the correspondence of small judges. And from slight incidents seen, as we today would say, as projective of wider currents of feeling. He lacked, as we shall see in a moment, in one particular, of course, the survey methods which today permit the less accessible and the less articulate in our society to tell their story or their lack of a story to the more articulate and the more accessible. But both in this country and in his researches on the causes of the French Revolution, he used, so to speak, informants, people who could tell the story of others, when he could not reach respondents, people who could tell their own story. And he filtered everything through this extraordinary grasp he had of what made sense as a gestalt. As a man relatively free from illusions, from self-deception, he had enough confidence in his own values and in his own judgment. And remember that when he came here, he was 26 years old, to be able to face the democratic future without obeisance and without wishfulness. To remind ourselves of this, it is helpful to go back, let us say, to Dickens's American Notes, or Martin Chuzzlewit, or to those of Francis Trollope or Anthony Trollope. Let us take Dickens for an illustration, since our time is short. Dickens is a patron of women, children, workers, prisoners, servants, and the other poor and oppressed. Came in 1842, he was then but 29, with prejudices very much in favor of this country. His experiences here must have been a little bit like that of travelers to the Soviet Union in the 20s, in the pre-purge 1930s, who were taken, as I know, for I was one of them, to visit model farms, model prisons, model nurseries, and parks of culture and rest. Everywhere he went, he saw the institutions American philanthropy had provided for orphans, for the insane, for what we would today call juvenile delinquents. He saw many model prisons. He was a kind of early student of American productivity in the direction of philanthropy. He went to the Lowell Mills, as many of the early visitors did. And these were a kind of extraordinary foreshadowing of, shall we say, the Hawthorne Electric Company of today. in their welfare services, their well-dressed women employees, their lack of gulfs, as in Europe, between the laboring classes and the elite. Can you all hear now? But Dickens was distracted by his sentiments. And America brought out his basic middle-class ambivalence about the status revolution. He liked improving the lot of the poor, but in a somewhat Lady Bountiful kind of way. And he was deeply hostile to slavery. But he did not like seeing ill-kempt men spitting on the White House carpets or lounging about without respect for the constituted authorities. Spitting got in the way of his vision. He had no windshield wiper, as it did in the case of Mrs. Trollope, just as other parvenu traits or coarsenesses obscured the vision of many visitors to the Soviet Union in the 20s. Tocqueville, incidentally, who as an aristocrat was not threatened in this way, noted that both coarseness and refinement were rarer in America than in Europe. Or perhaps it would be more accurate to say that Tocqueville came here knowing Europe better than other visitors who saw only certain sides of Europe. Perhaps Dickens made these misjudgments, as they now seem to us, precisely because he was such a fabulous master of individual psychology. The author of Great Expectations could not generalize Pip's mobility to that of America. He had no structural, no social scientific imagination. He notes a number of traits which struck other travelers too. American gregariousness, for instance, the American love of comfort. His picture of a steamboat, for example, could be readily transposed to the modern motel or bathroom. But this remains on the level of local color. And there has always been plenty of color in every sense to impress and to depress the visitor to this country. And I think the same verdict would have to be passed on the other visitors of Tocqueville's day, whose comments on America one can find in the collections of Handlin, of Nevins, of Commager, and also of the Americans themselves, who even then migrated a great deal to visit as well as to stay, and whose notes on this country have been collected in the three volumes edited by Tryon. Prejudice does not prevent good reporting. Look at Simone de Beauvoir's comments on Chicago, for example. But the day-by-day, scene-by-scene approach of such local colorists does divert one from the more fundamental issues, the issues of central tendency, of destiny, of relevance to the human career. Tocqueville's contribution here seems to me unique, then and now. It would be an exciting book, even if America had never existed. I should add that it was one of Tocqueville's advantages over Dickens that, so far as I know, he did not ride on a railway. Coming 11 years earlier, his America was somewhat more homogeneous, more pre-industrial, more encompassable. He did not have to fight the machine in quite the same way that later generations of French and other continental visitors have done. The factory system, in other words, and its consumer products did not distract him from the social system. Even here, of course, he foresaw more than he saw. In a famous chapter, he proposed that America might succumb to what he called an aristocracy of manufacturers, as it seemed later to succumb, and I am speaking now, not Tocqueville, to an oligarchy of one in the reign of Grant and his successors. But I am inclined to think that the shocks of recognition we have when we read Tocqueville now come partly from the fact that the country, following the debauch of an oligarchy in the Gilded Age, has once more, with the cutting off of immigration, with the leveling tendencies of our educational system, of our tax system, and of our media, has once more become more equalitarian in temper than it was in the post-Civil War period, and therefore more like Tocqueville's America. Of course, one can overdo the emphasis on equality and homogeneity. Then and now, and possibly in the lonely crowd, Messrs. Denny, Glaser, and I have overdone it. Tocqueville was brilliantly aware of the careful public relations of the rich in a democracy, how they take great care not to stand aloof from the poor, how they speak to them every day, how they don't put on airs. But even so, the swells he saw may have overconvinced him of the extent of their submergence by the Jacksonian Revolution, much as if today one went to Texas, one might be overconvinced by the big rich that taxes had prevented anybody from making a fortune. On the other side, Tocqueville observed that the lawyers were a kind of democratic elite, rising out of the people, maintaining through the jury system close ties with them, yet superior owing to their grasp of the complexities of the American legal and constitutional order. And one might argue today that the managers, some of whom originally lawyers, control the crucial decisions by means of similar monopolies of relevant knowledge, financial, technical, legal, and military. At the other end of society, at the bottom end, equally outside the great middle consensus, is a submerged stratum of people who do not yet live in democratic times, either in economic or in social terms. People who turn up as don't-knows on opinion polls, but people whom Tocqueville was not likely to have seen outside the slave states. In fact, contemporary social research, as I've indicated, puts us for the first time in the position to take a census of those who don't count. If we no longer have a submerged third, we have a submerged fourth or fifth in our rural and urban slums, many of them older or handicapped people, many of them Negroes. And these people are, in absolute terms, nearly as poor as they were a generation ago, and in relative terms, in lacking company for their misery, considerably poorer. The slow inflation which our political economy seems to require, and which incidentally Tocqueville also foresaw, saying that with equality in democratic times, wages would have to go up because people wanted the goods that they could buy. This slow inflation, which seems bound to continue since the opacities of the gold standard have been pierced by the new opacities of Keynes, makes life hard for the old and for the unorganized, including college professors, and we begin to have what Harvey Wheeler in a recent issue of Dissent terms an administered depression among certain kinds of white-collar and service workers. Similar inequalities appear when we go back to Tocqueville's discussion of freedom of association, that freedom which he saw as the American answer to the smallness of men and the massiveness of society once feudal strata were abolished. We know from the work of many social scientists that the social and economic underdog is also often an isolate, that he is not a joiner. He may, at the most, be a trade union member, possibly a church member, but to any significant sense, he is ungrouped. Sometimes he may have just the ties of the extended family, and these he may lose as he grows older. The elderly are the DPs of our society, without finding equivalent ties among the people in the city, and he may cling instead to the pseudo-intimacy of the mass media, to what my colleagues Donald Horton and the late Richard Wohl call the parasocial intimacy of the company one sees on a television screen or realizes in the studio audience. This is a change from Tocqueville's picture of America, which saw it as filled to overflowing with an infinite variety of associations, private and political, calling attention to each other in the newspapers. But I'm not sure whether it is actually so great a difference from the America that was here when Tocqueville came. In one area, at any rate, where we have some slight comparative data, participation today is ever so much greater. And this is in the sphere of religion. In the early 19th century, which we tend to picture as puritanical and evangelistic, church membership, especially among men, was a minority phenomenon in many places. In part, the conditions of membership were probably stricter, and non-members must have participated vicariously or in the periodic revivals. Still, one can find statistics of church membership in Illinois counties which show that not more than 10 or 20% of the people 100 years ago were church members, as compared with something like 60% today and a much greater proportion than that who go to church and an infinitely greater proportion who say they believe in God.
Listening to a 1958 lecture by Harvard sociologist David Reisman on From the Vault. For a copy of this program, please call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go to fromthevaultradio.org. And now, back to our program.
Indeed, we would expect that poverty and overwork, combined with the great distances of early rural America, where the European model of the village was so seldom brought over, deprived many people, and especially the women, of any chance for group ties outside the family. I sometimes think whiskey had more to do with conquering the frontier than the Bible did. Yet, as Tocqueville's discussion shows, neither economic nor ecological factors were the whole story. We know that lodges such as the Elks and Masons have declined relatively in American life, even while the churches have thrived. To be a Shriner no longer means today quite what it did. And the March of Dimes remains one of the few organizations whose local chapters span several layers of the class structure, in part because it is an episodic thing, and in part because it connects philanthropy both with a glamorous disease and a glamorous Roosevelt. This seems to me to have occurred because the status strivings Tocqueville treats in book three of his second volume is characteristic of democratic nations, by which, I quote, every man hopes to keep himself aloof lest he be carried away by the crowd against his will, that these strivings have in some small measure abated, or at any rate become more sophisticated, no longer to be satisfied by the Masonic Stag Party or the Eastern Star analog for the ladies' auxiliary. The cult of informality increasingly leads people to prefer the more informal, perhaps the smaller grouping. There are many fugitive groupings, like gangs of boys in college. At the same time, political activity in the national sense, that is, the democratic-republican sense, may play less part in the drama of associational life than in earlier days, while civic activity in the suburban sense plays a greater part, a theme I shall return to. Tocqueville wrote, "The Americans, who mingle so readily in their political assemblies and courts of justice, are wont, on the contrary, carefully to separate into small, distinct circles in order to indulge by themselves in the enjoyments of private life. Is this still true where the courthouse is no longer the arena of civic entertainment and the source of the latest inside dope? Do we not rather see in the suburbs a serious civic-mindedness which is increasingly shared by both sexes, combined with a retreat into the private life, less of a circle of friends than of a do-it-yourself family? The fear of others' distinction may be as strong as when Tocqueville wrote, but the drive for one's own distinction through joining a group with a flossy label, like the Shriners, other than the group provided by the suburb itself, may be becoming somewhat attenuated. And is the self-confidence which Tocqueville thought of as so astonishing among Americans, and which he saw as resulting from their ability to do it yourself in terms of forming associations, is this also attenuated? He speaks, Tocqueville does, of the extraordinary ability of Americans to found great undertakings in common, that is, without the kind of centralized direction characteristic of France. Once people have moved into the suburb, does the small-scale activity of the PTA or the Neighborhood Improvement League lead outward to the more intractable issues of the great metropolis? Or does the former not rather box in the activities in the suburb and therefore absorb the energies necessary to cope with larger national questions? While in wartime, what we might call the associational literacy of Americans, the organizational know-how, impressed all foreign observers, as well as Americans themselves. Has this quality become encapsulated so as no longer to make contact with large affairs? Whereas Tocqueville feared that the Democrat of future times would feel small in comparison with the serried mass of his fellows, those hidden persuaders of our own opinions, may it be that the great mass of American people in terms of population, and incidentally Tocqueville foresaw that too, saying this country would have 150 million people, and it and Russia would be the leading contenders for world power. When he came here, there were 13 million people. That is, does the great mass of Americans simply in population terms oppress us today, make us feel small, or do the size of our problems oppress us? Because the problems have grown even faster than we have. And if so, does this imply that the organizational inventiveness, which is still a new thing in the world, though Americans no longer hold a near monopoly on it, has not kept pace with the expanded range of situations requiring it? Less than 30 years after Tocqueville's visit, the self-confident Americans he had visited drove each other into a civil war, which revealed the limits of the large consensus formed by myriad private and local associational ties. Indeed, some of these associations, North and South, had a hand in bringing on the war and extending its ferocity. Tocqueville, gloomy man that he was, hardly expected that group life as an educative factor could contain all the chauvinist and militarist pressures that a society of men of equal condition could produce. But he insisted to no doubt incredulous French conservatives that their view of America, which regarded it as an amorphous mass without traditional or natural bulkheads, was wrong. is mistaken as a map of communications today in this country, which would include only rail lines and leave out roads and telephones. Though we may have somewhat underestimated the persistence of primary groups, he saw that the slender threads of group ties gave Americans what we would now term belongingness, and opposed and even frustrated centralized government. And he was aware that that government, as it did in France, could forbid associations and thereby limit the political schooling of Americans. He saw that an aristocratic nation, and this was the opposite pole of his concept of a democratic nation. He was working, that is, with two ideal types. Could not provide voluntary associations because people were too graded in status, and they could not link each other through interest, but only through their place in the status system. Correspondingly, men were born, not made, or self-made, and groups were born, not made. And since he thought that aristocracy was doomed, he tried to persuade its residual legatees in France and elsewhere to welcome freedom of association as a guarantee of that political liberty which might make equality somewhat bearable. Were he to visit this country now, he might be alarmed at the ways in which individuals called before government investigating bodies are asked to report on their friendship ties, their informal as well as formal networks of association, so that in this setting, the personal threatens to become political, the political personal, and the dangerous freedom is itself in danger. Perhaps I should moderate that last remark by reference to the Supreme Court decisions of last year, which, to the fury of Senator Eastland, put curbs on the committees and sought to reinvigorate freedom of speech and of association. These decisions bring me back to Tocqueville's comments on the bar as America's quasi-aristocracy. He had in mind the practicing bar, being relatively unaware of John Marshall's importance. Lawyers, of course, are still important in American legislation and American legislatures, but they are hardly an aristocracy, and their role in defending freedom has not been impressive in recent years. Many lawyers have feared to take the cases of men accused of subversive ties, lest they themselves be thought sympathetic to their clients, leaving the work of defense either to a few older aristocrats like Lloyd Garrison or to incompetent or communist-dominated small fry. I have the impression that lawyers today are more professionalized than in Tocqueville's day and less able, nevertheless, to face popular distrust. Apart from the need to be liked, they want, like the rest of us, to be loved, and they are seldom aristocratic in outlook, and this goes for judges for the most part. If we don't then have an aristocracy of lawyers, and I would argue, although I won't press the point now, perhaps we can talk about it in the discussion period, an aristocracy of manufacturers. The only elite which Tocqueville thought of as a potential elite, which has in fact become so, is the military. The other group, which hardly existed in the 1830s, is the managers. Though with hindsight to help us, we can see through the work of Leonard White and others that there were civil servants in the early administrations who have the atmosphere, the feel of a manager. Wright Mills, in his book, The Power Elite, contends that we are governed by three interlocking directorates of corporate, military, and political power, and that these constitute a true oligarchy. Hence, that the spirit of America has radically changed, irrevocably changed, since Tocqueville's day. I would agree with much of this, although I think we know very little about whether the directorate actually directs, whether there is anyone in charge, rather than, as Mills says, organized irresponsibility, we may have disorganized irresponsibility. Mills doesn't quite hold that democracy is a sham underneath which the decision makers go their way in cynical darkness, but neither does he admit that the democratic culture of the whole society influences the decision makers, other than in their public relations, influences them, that is, in their very exercise or non-exercise of power. The most important discussion I find in his material is that about the role of the military, though I would like to see distinctions drawn among the several services, whose oligopolistic competition is very much like that of the big three in automobiles, so much so that when Chrysler took over after General Motors and decided to go in for General Motors-type cars, I was struck that the Navy at about the same time gave up its fight against the other bigger services and went in for the same ferocity as the others. And yet our failure to follow Admiral Radford in all his bellicosity does indicate that there is at least a shred of civilian control left and not in complete abeyance. And if we go back to Tocqueville to try to understand the present situation better, we can find in Book 3 of Volume 2 a fabulously interesting discussion of the war proneness of officers in a democracy and of the difficulty of staying out of a war in a democratic era in a world resonant society. But he was in America before the Irish immigration really got underway and before nativist movements made plain the extent of American xenophobia, except as far as the indigenous population was concerned. Thus, he may not have realized the dynamite of populist bellicosity in America, which could be inflamed as in the Mexican and Spanish wars, or towards the Japanese in World War II, or in the Cold War at present. But there has recently come to light correspondence between Tocqueville and the Comte de Gobineau, which, like so much of democracy in America, is relevant today. Gobineau, who, as you know, was the pioneer, perhaps the pioneer racist, scientific racist of modern times, had been helped and patronized by Tocqueville, who employed him for a time as his secretary. But Tocqueville was aghast at the racialist theories Gobineau was developing. He regarded them as implausible in scientific terms, arguing that the mere fact that certain races had developed more than others in terms, let's say, of hegemony, was no evidence that this was because they were genetically superior. To argue in this way from hindsight was what we would today call historicism. Moreover, he pointed out that all one had to go on was recorded history, and that there might have been in human history many races which had died out, which had made important contributions. He suggested that there were many alternatives in history which Gobineau could not possibly have discovered, the evidence being vanished, which would give a sense of what different races, now apparently submerged, might have accomplished. So Tocqueville thought Gobineau was unscientific where he pretended to be scientific. But more than that, He saw the demagogic danger and the appeal and menace of racism precisely in a democratic world, where it might provide a form of superiority for men who had lost an aristocracy. In this perspective, he felt it was irresponsible of Gobineau to propagate dubious opinions which could only depress the races which were already depressed and make over-proud the already arrogant. Man of principle that he was, he broke with Gobineau when he could not persuade him. It would be historicist of us to emphasize only the prophecies of Tocqueville that came true and ignore those that did not. Even those that came true do not necessarily prove him right. He may have avoided explanations which would have been better, or missed factors which were responsible for seeming to prove him right. But what is striking when one reads him now is the extent to which he avoided the kinds of determinism fashionable in his day and later. He rejected not only racial explanations, but geographic or environmental ones. And the picture he presents of America is still a complex one of many factors, many interrelated networks of influence. He focused, of course, on what was different from his own experience. And he may have overstressed, as may have writers since his time, the race for fortune and place in a democracy, the vertigo of mobility, overlooking the many Americans who, how should I say, contracted out of all that, who stay in place in order that others need not do so. While he had the insight to realize that even in a rural America, the drive towards equality turned peasants into tradesmen and farmers into land speculators, he missed those enclaves which adhered more closely to the land, the family, the community. In the novels of Roald Vogg, of Willa Cather, in Glenway Westcott's magnificent The Grandmothers, the sense of existential drama in rural living comes through in a way that it does not in Tocqueville, where he sees all Americans as aspirants to status and as suffering only through their decline in the race for consumption. It would follow that America in Tocqueville's time and now may not have been so individualistic as he thought. For one thing, Tocqueville was a man, talking mostly to other men, to prison officials, to lawyers, to frontiersmen, hotel keepers, to Justice Story, and to the Secretary of State. He went into homes. He heard women playing lachrymose accompaniments on the piano. He saw the new American woman, free and bold. But he did not focus on domestic life and not on child rearing. Even so, his methods have always seemed to me closer to those of a visiting anthropologist than has been the case with any other visitor to America, until Lloyd Warner came back from Africa, or rather Australia, to look at Yankee City 100 years after Tocqueville. Tocqueville and Beaumont spent 9 months in this country, a characteristic anthropological period of gestation. After each interview, they took copious notes, and they divided up, as a husband and wife team of anthropologists might, with Beaumont undertaking to emphasize the race question, while Tocqueville focused on politics and mainly on the North. They used both men who knew this country or aspects of it, and talk to anybody they could encounter in the streets. By making the study of prisons and American superiority in this area their manifest purpose, they disarmed American sensitivity, which was very great towards foreign observers. And in the very order of their publications, they resemble what anthropologists do. They first published their ethnography of prisons, so to speak, and then Tocqueville published, 2 years later, the more ethnographic part of his work, that is, the first volume of Democracy in America, dealing with the more factual material. And then after 5 years of further reflection, this second volume with the more cultural material and the more abstract discussion of the American system. In that volume, he deals with American culture in the high, the low, and the anthropological sense. He talks about religion, talks about the tone and temper and quality and feel of American life, and what it means to those who endure it. And throughout, he is, unlike most anthropologists, preoccupied with change, with the impalpable rise of the common man, and the quicker and more explosively revolutionary development which had marked his own family's vicissitudes during and after the French Revolution. He came here with preconceptions, but he was willing to listen. One of the things that struck him most in this country, and which most differentiates his account from any other I know, is his sense of the softening of manners in America. Here he is so much at odds with Dickens and Mrs. Trollope, for example. In our terms today, we would say that he discovered empathy, that he saw that as people became more equal, they identified more with each other, and they became less cruel. He noticed that the kinds of savage executions or pleasure in torture, characteristic of past times in Europe, was quite absent here, and that even when there was, as in the case of the slaves, a considerable difference of master and man, there was nevertheless a bond of sympathy between them. Indeed, it goes without saying that both he and Beaumont saw Indians and Negroes as persons, not as objects. In studying both America and Tocqueville, we can profit from his method even now, or perhaps especially now, when our commitments tend to be less firm, our ambitions less exalted, our fear of error and of uncertainty more pervasive.
Well, indeed, that was an interesting perspective in 1958 by Harvard sociologist David Riesman. Of course, we'd love to hear a perspective from a W.E.B. Du Bois or a Howard Zinn, Noam Chomsky, John Trudell, Dr. Martin Luther King, and some others about that assessment. But again, Harvard sociologist David Riesman, recorded in 1958 by the Pacifica Radio Archives. That does it for our show. And that does it for this edition of From the Vault. If you would like to get a copy of this program, call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230 or search our entire collection at pacificaradioarchives.org. I've been your host, Mark Torres. Thanks for keeping our history alive.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory,
glory, glory.
Oh,
the heavens, no man, no weapon, form warned against. Yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtapositioning us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be now the war is not over, victory isn't won. But we'll fight on to the finish, and then when it's all done, we'll cry glory.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, KBOO.FM. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy viernes 30 de julio del 2021. El embajador de la Gran Bretaña en la Organización de las Naciones Unidas advirtió que la mitad de la población de Birmania, de 54 millones, podría contraer COVID-19 en las próximas 2 semanas en medio de la agitación en curso tras un golpe militar en febrero. Pakistán está promulgando una prohibición de viajar en avión para cualquiera que no pueda presentar un